Hello and welcome back to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. And today we've got what we consider to be one of the more interesting lectures for the year, the Socrates Award Lecture for 2004. And what we've tried to do here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology each year is let the students drive one lecture a year, give the students the ability to vote for the Socrates Award. And the criteria for the Socrates Award, as all of you are well aware at this point, is that it is something about a poison, a group of poisons, some sort of concern out there that might have appeared in the media. It might be overhyped in terms of it really isn't a risk, but the media likes to say the sky is falling. Or it might be something that always has existed out there, but is just starting to get a little bit more media attention. And sometimes there's incidents out in the public arena that actually bring these subjects to the forefront, and we get a little bit of concern. On the other side of it, sometimes these sorts of poisons, chemicals of concern, actually come to us because of new advances in scientific knowledge. And this new knowledge is coupled with a little bit of new information about risk and risk management. And so in the past, we've had a wide variety of substances actually examined in the Socrates Award Lecture, chosen by students. Pharmaceuticals and personal care products in the environment. What happens when you flush, so to speak, to some of the bioactive substances that go out in the human waste stream. Those products that you use in your hair and on your body and in your home use, what happens when that re-enters the ecosystem in terms of a life cycle assessment. We've also looked at the agents of chemical warfare, toxicology used in anger. In one of our subjects. And then also dirty bombs last year, in terms of what sorts of chemical concerns, radiological concerns might we have in a situation where this material is dispersed across the environment in some act of terrorism. We've also looked at household mold, a big concern in the warmer, moister climates of the world and of the southwestern United States in terms of potential fungal mycotoxins. Well, today, the Socrates Award Lecture 2004 is on the subject of the environmental toxicology of mercury. Okay? And in the past year, many of us have seen a lot of new interest and concerns, heightened advisories in terms of the role of mercury in neurotoxicity, the dietary exposure of mercury via fish consumption. And so what I'm going to try to do today is actually give you an overview of mercury in the environment and in the human food chain. And actually we'll look at a couple of case studies that try to highlight not what happens when mercury becomes a human health disaster. And we'll try to look at as well, when we finish up this lecture, what we've learned from episodes and how we've, in the public arena, have developed policies to deal with that and what the current state of affairs is. Well, mercury is one of those elements that actually comes to us with a long history. One of the most interesting ones from a historical perspective, found in nature as mercury sulfide, and that's because the KSP, or the solubility product of mercury sulfide, is enormously low. I think it's 10 to the minus 28th or so. So it's incredibly insoluble, therefore it makes a nice mineral in terms of the environment, which is already always shuttered in some sort of aqueous weathering. It comes to us actually because it's a very noticeable mineral, and on the right-hand side of this slide you see the mineral form of this. Cinnabar or vermilion are the two common historical names for it, but the bright redness of this particular mineral is what actually attracted many to it. Remember that the ancients used for their hardware store, for their art shelves, for their pantries, what happened in nature. And when a red rock, a bright red rock, was found, this is something that actually gave color to their lives. Mercury also can exist in nature in mineral form as native mercury, as the liquid form. You crack a rock, typically it is a rock that is also saturated in either mercury oxides or mercury sulfides as well, but because of the specific concentrations, there can be micro droplets of liquid mercury there. Okay, so this is something that nature's hardware store has provided to us, and in fact, its uses and its curiosity in terms of a liquid metal, a shiny liquid metal, a bright red rock, there develops many, many uses among ancient populations. There's evidence of ancient mining in Spain, Italy, China. Mercury has been found in 1500 BC Egyptian tombs, so it has been around for quite a long time. Its use as an amalgam to extract and purify gold is of ancient origin as well. What's less known is actually its use as a bright red pigment. And again, the artists looking to express themselves over past eons, prehistoric and historic, would see this bright red rock, or in other cases, a green rock or other colors. They would grind up this fine powder and use this as an ink or a pigment to illustrate or to draw representations of art. On the left-hand side, I show a an illuminated manuscript. And one of my hobbies is art chemistry, and I've dealt with many illuminated manuscripts in my history, including the Gutenberg Bible. These are typically done by monks. They're painstakingly done over long, long periods of time, great detail, bright colors quite often. And even in this, you can see the bright red print from cinnabar or vermilion red ink. And in the illumination itself, next to the blues and the yellows, you see some of these bright reds. And again, these are mercury sulfide-based pigments. Interestingly enough, mercury sulfide, cinnabar vermilion as a pigment lasted into actually recent history because it was such a good red. It had great persistence. As you go to your favorite art museum and you see the paintings of the masters, quite often the reds you see, in fact, are mercury sulfide in origin. Interestingly enough, painters, manuscript illuminators, would to try to make those very fine points actually insert the tip of their brushes to get a fine point into their mouth, and you can imagine about just the potential exposure of some of these mercury compounds to this particular class of artisan. Mercury is also found in mythology. Hermes, the Greek messenger, Mercury, comes to us in where it actually derives its primary name in current use. It has been considered to be an element of mystery. Native mercury, argentum, vivium silver, alive silver. It actually was a part of the major cupboard chemicals of the early alchemists. It was actually formed from condensing the heated vapor of cinnabar to form this water silver or quicksilver. The alchemist symbol of mercury, and also the planet symbol up here, the horned symbol, is one that's fairly well known. But in fact, in the 16th and 17th and 18th century, mercury was actively used in alchemy and early chemistry because of many, many properties that were desirable. Along with its use and its activity in human economics, things like mining, there is a lot of reports of early toxicity associated with mercury exposure. Not necessarily knowledgeable in terms of the specific cause and effect because of all of the other threats to life and livelihood at those points in time, but still something that was remarked on. Its appearance in terms of alchemy is a highly celebrated one. There's an early Latin text in the 12th century, the Turba Philosophorum. It's one of the first or original texts in alchemy. It's a collection of essays of some of the earliest alchemists, the recipes of the recipes. This gives you an idea of mercury and its relationship to gold. In some of the quotes here, in the estimation of all sages, mercury is the first principle of all metals. As flesh is generated from coagulated blood, so gold is generated out of coagulated mercury. Gold being an economic metal, and everyone wanted to be able to produce it the easy way. And so transferring either lead or gold or mercury into gold was one of the tasks of the early alchemists. I'm not so sure they actually ever got there, at least to my knowledge. Well, one of the things that we did discover early on in terms of mining is that mercury is a part of the natural environment, okay? And it has some unique physical characteristics, and some of these physical characteristics actually yield some of the demonstrable sort of physical chemistry, biochemistry, biogeochemistry cycling patterns in the environment. But in terms of the global cycling of mercury, everything in terms of elements on the planet starts off as a mineral resource. And we as organisms and our, as well as bacterium and life forms intermediate, including plant life, aid in this biogeochemical cycling. But mercury, in terms of it having a source, is intimately linked to soils, the general atmosphere, and water bodies, and in particular, the ocean. In terms of primary sources, obviously any sort of mineral weathering on the surface of any sort of geological material that's exposed to wind and rain and oxidation at the planet's surface has the potential to release not only mercury as zero valent or elemental mercury, what we normally see, but also divalent mercury in its ionic form. Volcanic action is an important part of this as well. And what we see is an interface here between water, between atmosphere, and then finally deposition and recycling in this global cycle. If we break it down into particular steps, we see a degassing of mercury from rock, soils, and surface water, or emissions from volcanoes or human activities. We have movement in gaseous form, and that can be as zero valent or as an alkyl mercury or dialkyl mercury volatile compound. The movement in gases go through the atmosphere, they deposit on land and surface water, and because the planet is primarily ocean, it is a larger area of surface for potential deposition. We have potential conversion of the element into insoluble mercury sulfide, and that can happen abiotically or biotically in the presence of sulfide, again, because the KSP, the solubility product constant of mercury, is so low, the thermodynamics is so great for that in terms of its stability. We can find that we have precipitation or bioconversion via algae, microbes, such as fungi, into more volatile or soluble form, such as methylmercury. It can then re-enter the atmosphere, or because it's done in the lower trophic levels of the food chain, it can actually bioaccumulate up the food chain. When a mercury atom bioaccumulates up the food chain, it does not disappear. There is an increase up the trophic level, and we've talked about bioaccumulative toxins in this course. At the end of that, we have someone's body, yours, mine, a fish, a dog, a cat, a bird, that is a reservoir of mercury, and in the decomposition of our bodies, we actually return that to the mercury cycle. As you can imagine, there is great interest, for instance, in the human funeral process of cremation, because what we are doing is taking a body and actually potentially releasing that mercury out into the atmosphere. What is of great interest is the aquatic mercury cycle, a subset of the biogeochemical cycling, the global cycling of mercury. And what we find here is that from an environmental toxicology point of view, zero valent mercury and divalent mercury, mercury salts, are relatively low toxicity. But what happens is in the lower trophic levels, and typically by sulfate reducing bacteria, and we've talked about this class of anaerobic bacteria, it's not the only class of bacteria that can do this, but these are primary in the environment, especially anaerobic environments. But through various processes, and some of these processes might be involved with the production of sulfide in the sulfate respiration cycle of sulfate reducing bacteria, sequestering local mercury because of the KSP as well, and then using somehow or another that localized mercury, whether it's absorbing it, using it enzymatically to actually bioalkylate this. This is a well-known reaction, although the pathway is not and the purpose is not well understood. But what we have essentially is the formation of this cationic compound here, methyl mercury, and that can be a chloride or a hydroxide counteranion there. But this actually is lipid soluble. It's it binds with many functional groups in organisms. And as you look at the food chain in terms of smaller fish being eaten by larger fish and on up the food chain in terms of predators, you can see that there is a potential for biomagnification and bioaccumulation. In our modern environment, about 70% of the mercury comes from sources that we generate. A lot of these are waste sources. I'm not talking about mining and manufacturing from a point of view of product that's actually being used, but on the other part of life cycle assessment, what happens when it is actually released back into the environment. Those sources include metal mining and smelting, municipal and medical waste incineration, sewerage, because sewerage, whether it be as a byproduct or a raw sewerage, like a sewer sludge, that mercury that might be resident in that material has the ability to bioalkylate and be released as vapor and enter the mercury cycle once again. Coal fire power plants are a source of big concerns, and again, once we identify any sort of point source, it's one of those points of potential management and potential regulation, and quite often the generation of that regulation is because of its concern in terms of the mass flux out of these point sources. Cement manufacturing being another one, and this has a lot to do with its calcining or the high temperature process associated with slacking lime in cement manufacturing. Mining just opening up large tracts of ground, which are quite often pyritic, sulfide deposits, might have trace mercury. It may not be the economic mineral of interest, but there is potential weathering and release of mercury on that site. Volcanic eruption can also be a major source in terms of the ability to volatilize any sort of mercury minerals at the temperatures of volcanic activity. There's estimates that in the past 100 years, due to industrialization, there's been about a threefold increase in environmentally available mercury due to the fact that we're actually actively concentrating, actively extracting this mineral, and actually dispersing it out into the environment in terms of anthropogenic uses, and there have been many. One of the concerns is that mercury is a PBT. It is persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. Okay, and what we've talked about in this course is that chemicals that are PBT are ones of greatest concern. Things like dioxins, we've talked about some of the chlorinated hydrocarbons and their role in transfer into the liposphere. Mercury uses. Well, why all this mercury out there? Well, we find that it has these wonderfully unique properties, including being a liquid metal at room temperature. We use it to conduct electricity, to measure temperature and pressure. We use it to as a biocide, as a preservative, and as a disinfectant and in reactive chemistry. And I've listed here many, many current and older chemical uses. They're out there. They're of interest and concern. I'll let you go through this list. I'll pull out a few of them here. Mercury is well known in scientific apparatus. All of those that have entered a chemistry laboratory have probably seen liquid mercury. I know when I was in elementary school, I remember discovering in my elementary school laboratory a bottle, probably 20 pounds worth of mercury. And after school, we thought it was really neat to play with this in our hands and roll it around. It was just wonderful. And in a certain sense, our innocence at that age is probably akin to the innocence of some folks older history where they really didn't understand the relationship of toxicity and mercury, but it was just a neat and almost fun thing to play with. It is very heavy to hold in your hand. It's a liquid, it's shiny, it's very attractive, it is very unique and mysterious material. It is in pesticides because it has wonderful fungicidal activity, bacteriostatic activity. It's in vaccines. Many of the vaccines that we will take, if you read the bottle, it will contain thimerosal. Thimerosal is a mercury compound, organomercurial antibacterial, that is going to keep bacteria from growing in this particular vial. It has been used in human and animal vaccines. It has been used in industrial processes. Probably the most famous is the what is referred to as the chloralkali process, where mercury is used as a liquid electrode, and it converts seawater at the application of power into chlorine gas, Cl2, which has many, many industrial uses. Down here at the bottom, I have a photo of a common household thermostat switch. And in some thermostats, still in houses, you can open up the front panel of it and see a mercury switch. When you see one of these kids, these 5-year-olds running down the street in the evening with these shoes that light up with every step they take, there's little mercury switches in there. And some parents have become very concerned once they find that, not for toxicology reasons, because there's no real exposure, but just because they're a part of the problem in terms of the dissemination and use of mercury and kind of using it for something that might be regarded as being a less than necessary use. Well, in terms of our recent history, we have had some observations of mercury toxicity. Many of you have probably heard of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland character, the Mad Hatter. The Mad Hatter was actually a bit of the local flavor at that time. It was well known that people who worked in the beaver felt factories processing the beaver felts used for the attractive tall hats at the time were actually sometimes regarded to be a little bit on the mad side. The madness really wasn't an insanity necessarily. It was more of an irritability, low-level chronic mercury toxicity. Much of this was reversible. The beaver pelts, because again they were an organic material, would degrade like any sort of skin material, fur material, and they needed to be preserved. And mercury salts were actually used as a preservative to keep bacterial degradation out of the skins, again, used for these tall hats of the time. Mercury has had a large role in medicine. The use of mercury salts in the 19th century for the treatment of syphilis actually didn't do much for syphilis, but it did put people on the pathway because this was a chronic sort of manifestation towards mercury toxicosis and associated renal failure. Mercury compounds in the past have been used as diuretics, anti-infectives, laxatives, eye and skin treatments. I know when I was growing up, there was a common medicine chest antiseptic called mercurochrome, which is an organomercurial compound. And so this actually has been out there. It does have a use. I'm here to tell you that my mom putting mercurochrome on my cuts did not have a neurotoxic effect. But all things considered, in modern science, we have a lot better antiseptics, a lot better diuretics. Interestingly enough, and this is of great interest to us here in the Pacific Northwest, not 20 miles from the pathway of the Lewis and Clark expedition, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, where Lewis and Clark opened up the U.S. West. And for several years, they went out on these backcountry journeys, and one of the things that they had to do is bring with them a good medicine chest, because they were going to have a pretty long path home if someone got sick on the road. And there's some speculation, and in fact, I've read the Lewis and Clark journals about Meriwether Lewis, because as one of the primary sort of doctors on there, he did a lot of self-treatment for the gastrointestinal upset associated with bacterial infection, eating poor food, parasitic infection, a lot of stomach disturbances, some might call them ulcers. The quality of food many times on the trip is extremely poor. And towards the end, especially if you read the journal entries and some of the documents written by others, Meriwether Lewis, on his return to the eastern United States, did not survive very long, and in fact had some manifestations associated with potential mercury toxicity. Was it mercury toxicity or not? I'm not sure we'll ever know. Mercury, in terms of its primary physiological toxicity, organ-based target organ toxicity, is nephrotoxic. It does have an effect on the membrane of the proximal tubule cell. This actual action of mercury, organomercurial salts, actually has been exploited, because mercury binds to some of the sulfhydryl groups, these thiol groups of membrane proteins, and it acts as a diuretic by inhibiting sodium reabsorption. Okay, so it actually, in the 1920s to the 1960s, was actively used in clinical practice as a diuretic. One of those compounds, Mersallo, I've written the chemical formula here, actually looked it up last night. It's about $300 for about 5 grams, so it's a very expensive drug to take. One of the things that you need to know is that mercuries is still used in selective application in several pharmaceutical compounds. And quite often the assessment is the disease going to kill the host, or and if it's an infectious or a parasitic disease, sometimes the risk benefit in terms of taking drugs or therapies that are in themselves quite toxic is reasonable. And we understand that a little bit now in terms of dose response and responses that we would like and desire in terms of minimizing disease progression versus dose endpoints that include toxicity and potentially death. One of the biggest endpoints of concern with mercury has to do with methylmercury and its role in the manifestation of neurotoxicity. And when you talk about mercury and you talk about risk management and you talk about personal risk in terms of exposure to mercury, what you're typically talking about is the neurotoxicity manifestations of methylmercury. All forms of mercury are neurotoxic, but methylmercury is considered to be highly neurotoxic. And in fact, it's quite interesting, because human physiology does actually de-alkylate mercury. And mercury toxicity, in terms of the chemical biochemical pathway, is somewhat understood, but not in the way that we really need to in terms of knowing and understanding this. Obviously, one has to think that its reactivity with sulfur groups, with thiols, with proteins, and with some critical functioning areas on neurons is a large part of the pathway of toxicity for this particular compound. It's interesting that levels of methylmercury too low to show a postnatal effect can be neurotoxic to a developing fetus. And so, as we've said many times in this course, focusing our concern in terms of exposure on developing neurological systems in utero, in infants, and in children is where the current phenomenon in terms of application of toxicology in human health is primarily directed. One of the concerns in terms of the pathway, if methylmercury is of the largest concern in terms of relative toxicity of the mercury compounds, what is the major vector in terms of human exposure? Well, the major vector, as it turns out, is fish consumption. Fish consumption, fish do because of their place on the trophic chain, actually do bioaccumulate methylmercury. Sea mammals and shellfish also contain methylmercury. It's quite interesting that the various sulfur-type compounds, like metallothionein, which includes some sulfur binding, some selenium compounds, actually interact. We've talked at length about selenium in this course. When you analyze tissues of marine mammals, for example, what you actually find in some tissues is a 1-to-1 molar concentration ratio between mercury and selenium. And so there is some sort of sympathetic interaction there in terms of bioaccumulation of mercury and selenium. The major source of methylmercury in the aquatic environment is atmospheric mercury deposited, and it is then biomethylated by microorganisms and then biomagnified up the food chain. In the U.S., what we find is that most fish have less than 0.5 parts per million methylmercury, but the more carnivorous a fish is, the higher that can bioaccumulate. And when we look at large fish, tuna, shark, and swordfish in the oceans, these will typically have methylmercury levels in excess of one part per million. So we actually do see fish advisories, especially for pregnant women, for example, that you should kind of limit your consumption of these predatory fish, such as tuna, shark, and swordfish. It's not that one serving is going to get you, but it shouldn't be a major component of your diet. Now, this is a particular challenge, as we'll see, in terms of risk analysis. If you live in a community or subset of people where seafood is a major part of your diet, okay? Well, in terms of methylmercury exposure, focusing on infants and children is one of the primary modes of epidemiological risk assessment. These health concerns arise from in utero exposure. Infants and children can be exposed to methylmercury via breast milk and also from consumption of fish and fish products. Okay, so it's methylmercury, children, and fish products somewhere in the food chain. In terms of human exposure and incidence, the ones that are the unfortunate incidents that are in our collective environmental history, two stick out as being some of the largest. The first one in the 1950s, methylmercury poisoning from an industrial discharge in Japan, known as the Minamata disease incident. We find that about 21,000 individuals filed claims as victims, and about 3,000 were certified as actually having the disease in some fashion. Nearly 600 people died in this particular incident. And what they found there, and again, this is the 1950s, post-World War II science had developed, but in terms of analytical or environmental chemistry knowledge, toxicological chemistry knowledge, we really didn't have the sophistication of information and analysis and investigation that we do today. They did actually, in this particular case, as we'll see in our case study, figure out that there was a cycle from this discharge into the nearby bay, into the fish they caught. And there was a very, very widespread manifestation of neurological impairment in the local community. A little bit more recently, in 1971-72 in Iraq, there was a poisoning outbreak associated with consumption of bread. And this bread was made from seed grain that was coated with a methylmercury fungicide. For those of you that grew up on farms, in most recent history, any sort of seed treatment, and the problem with seed in the barn is that if there's any moisture associated with the storage conditions, that seed will sprout, or that seed will decay, become infected with fungus or bacterial slime. Typically, what happens in terms of farm operations or more modern agriculture is those seeds have some sort of treatment. But typically what happens is if there is a fungicidal treatment on seed, they're also dyed with a bright red or a blue or a green color, okay? And so that's a clear chemical sort of marker that this grain, even though it looks like wheat that you can grind up for flour, should not be eaten, okay? On this particular case, and by the way, horses and cattle, To this day, I am associated with the diagnostic toxicology, veterinary diagnostic toxicology lab, and at least on a monthly basis, we find toxicology cases of animals that get into treated grain and have disease manifestations of toxicology, not necessarily methylmercury, but there's a whole range of other fungicidal compounds. In this particular outbreak, there were about 6,000 people affected and 439 died. In terms of methylmercury and Minamata, I thought it was quite interesting in my research on this that only 6 weeks ago, and I don't put this up there so that you can read it, I put it there so I can read it, but I thought it was interesting that even 6 weeks ago, this case is still active in the courts. And this particular Associated Press article reads, Japan's top court orders government to pay Minamata mercury poisoning victims 22 years after case filed. And this is October 15th, 2004. And I'll read some of this. Japan's top court ordered the government Friday to pay $700,000 in damages to victims of Minamata mercury poisoning after their famous case was filed over industrial pollution disaster that killed more than 1,700 people and caused diseased mothers to give birth to deformed babies. After the decision, several plaintiffs rushed to the courthouse and furled a banner declaring their victory to cheering supporters. The government apologized to the victims for failing to prevent the pollution. We assure you that this horrific incident won't ever be repeated, Environment Minister Yokiro Koike said, making a deep bow to plaintiffs in a meeting after the verdict. The government will tell about the lessons learned here for generations to come. And we'll talk about this attitude in terms of a learning experience here as we develop this case study. The Minamata poisoning was Japan's worst case of industrial pollution since the 1950s. Hundreds of people have contracted Minamata disease, a neurological disorder caused by mercury poisoning from eating tainted fish. The disease, first discovered in the 1950s, was named for Minamata Bay in southern Japan, where a company dumped tons of mercury compounds. Babies of poisoned mothers were born with gnarled limbs. The victims were seared into memory by a famous series of photographs by W. Eugene Smith, a Life magazine photographer, from the 1970s, including one of a woman holding her deformed child in a bathtub. The case came to symbolize the dark side of Japan's remarkable growth to the world's second largest economy in the post-World War II era. According to government figures, 29,555 people have contracted Minamata disease and 1,700 people have since died. Under a special law, victims can receive free medical care and compensation. About 12,000 people who were sickened had received a one-time government payout but were not eligible for free medical care. So in fact, this is a part of our current environmental history, or part of your environmental history, of something that actually predates the birth of most students in this course. One of the big associated, representations of this, if you recall the 1950s, we've talked about here somewhat predates a lot of environmental activism in the United States and perhaps in the world. It wasn't necessarily in our face the way it is today in terms of concerns. The media was not what it is today in terms of reporting. And in fact, this particular situation suffered from many things, including just a lack of knowledge of what exactly was going on from a disease manifestation point of view. This is actually a picture of W. Eugene Smith, the life photographer, who in the early 1970s, so this is well after the initial diagnosis of the disease and the processes, and so we were starting to get into kind of the chronic exposure scenario, not the acute, but the years after, of people that had been exposed to very, very high loads of methylmercury even 20 years ago. And this individual and his wife and companions actually went to Japan to kind of do a photojournalism documentary of what was going on. One of the classic photos, which you can actually see in the background of his picture here, is Tomoko in her bath. This picture, which you can still find on the internet, it was published in Life magazine, is a gripping photograph. I chose this one because it's out of focus. Although it is available and can be seen, it is a very intimate portrait of a mother bathing her gnarled daughter. It was taken with permission of the parents of Tomoko to highlight and bring to the world's attention the problems associated with the Minamata disease. After Tomoko passed away, actually, her parents asked for return of the photos to essentially let their daughter rest in peace, because it has been such a photograph that highlights the human side of Minamata disease. Well, Minamata disease is best defined as a neurological disorder caused by the ingestion of large quantities of fish or shellfish contaminated with methylmercury, and this was by two industrial effluents in Minamata and Niigata, Japan. Okay? And it's not to say that this disease would not be called this in other parts. In fact, we found methylmercury causing this same sort of neurotoxicological formations. What have we learned from the Minamata experience? As we open this case study, it's good to actually look backwards before we go back in history. We find that mercury pollution in the environment has created some serious hazards for man. Because it is persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic, it is of great concern. Human and health considerations must be integrated into the processes of economic and industrial development from a very early stage. We need life cycle assessment as we put chemicals out into the environment. We have to have good knowledge, the precautionary principle, if you will, about what the relative risks are. Where is this going? Where will it end up? This was a situation that I don't think the individuals really knew that there was going to be the outcome. And if you look at the billions and billions of dollars spent in terms of environmental cleanup and compensation, plus the tremendous loss of human life and human health and public health in this area of Japan, a little forethought probably would have been well considered. In terms of the chronology of Minamata disease, we need to go back to 1956. When we saw the first report of this unknown disease to the Minamata Public Health Center, there was some restraint measures to restrict intake of fish because what was happening was that they didn't know exactly what was causing the disease, but it seemed to be located with fish and shellfish, and this had to do with people that were eating that, obviously, in this particular part of the world as a coastal community, but also because the family cats associated with the human disease manifestations, the family cats were exhibiting similar signs and symptoms, cats being perhaps eating the leftovers from the meals. The conditioning cats was referred to dancing cats because they lost the ability to walk effectively. It goes on up through the 60s and 70s and into the 80s in terms of the chemical companies associated with the manufacturing. In this particular case, it was mercury being used as a catalyst in the manufacturing of acetaldehyde. In 1969, and again, this is very similar to many of the laws for pollution and water pollution that were being developed in the United States as well. Laws were being developed in Japan in terms of looking for pollution and monitoring and managing pollution out into the environment. In terms of some of the court action, we start seeing it fairly early in there. There was a lot of court suits to find out who was responsible, and more importantly, who was going to pay, whether it be compensation or for the environmental cleanup. One of the directions of environmental cleanup, the identity in terms of where mercury was going to be the major problem, was dredging the bottom sediment of Minamata Bay. That dredging actually continued up through 1990. One of the big problems as Minamata disease initially manifested itself was looking for the cause. And as I've said, it wasn't quite clear. And at the time, it appeared to be neurological. And so there was some concern that maybe it was an encephalitis or a chemical intoxication or some sort of food poisoning associated with fish or shellfish that were being consumed. So at least the exposure vector was determined early on, but the chemical or microbial agent was not necessarily discerned early on. As it turns out, men and women of all ages, excluding the infants, were actually became diagnosed, and again, the cats and the victims' families showed similar symptoms, and that's what actually helped make this linkage that it was somehow a food poisoning vector in terms of the progression of the disease. One of the things was also in terms of the disease investigation that was of interest was where was this coming from? As they started looking around for potential actions, looking at the local large chemical plant, Chiso in Minamata was obviously a prime target. There was a large discharge into the bay from this acetaldehyde manufacturing plant, and that something in the water was being a concern. As it turns out, mercury was not suspected at the beginning, and it was quite a long time before mercury actually came to the forefront as being kind of identified as the primary disease-causing agent. This had a lot to do with the fact that many of the manifestations of the disease were neurotoxic. There's a lot of neurotoxins out there. And this particular etiology, and especially when it comes to methylmercury, was not observed in modern history before. There have been a lot of anecdotal evidence data about people that worked, for instance, in mining operations being exposed to inorganic mercury or liquid mercury, but not methylmercury. In terms of looking at this cycling, this is a stick diagram of the Chiso Company manufacturing plant. Acetaldehyde is a chemical that is a starting product actually used in the synthesis of many chemicals, including acetic acid. What we do is we take acetylene and we use a mercury catalyst to form acetaldehyde. The waste product there, methylmercury, it was actually being directly discharged from the plant, as was the case with many industrial discharges in the 1950s. It was being directly discharged into Minamata Bay. Unfortunately, as it went to the bottom sediments and up the trophic chain, the fish in the bay, a primary food source for the local population, we saw biocumulative effects, we saw human exposure effects via fish and shellfish. One of the problems, as I've said, is that the formal clinical knowledge, the things that we knew about mercury toxicity, was not methylmercury, okay? And so this disease, as we find out, is clearly distinguishable from traditional industrial mercury poisoning. And that's why it took 12 years to kind of research what the cause was come to some sort of an official conclusion about what was the cause of this outbreak. And again, we're talking about 1950s, 1960s technology. I can tell you, as being a laboratory scientist, methylmercury analysis is non-trivial even today in 2004. Okay, so this is a particularly challenging laboratory assay. Total mercury, a lot easier. Okay, scientific knowledge about this experience and experience with transmission of mercury compounds of the food chain was very limited. We really didn't understand persistent bioaccumulative toxins in the environment the way we really understand them now. And so we just didn't have the knowledge, the techniques, the scientific apparatus to really do a good disease investigation. So although this seems like a long time and there was great tragedy in the amounts of human suffering, it wasn't necessarily due to a cause of folks that were not interested. There is some accusations, especially in the court, that this was a company town. And the company and the doctors, the public health officials, the government workers weren't real interested in slapping the hand of the company that was providing a lot of jobs, a lot of impact, positive impact on the local economy. And so there is some assertion that governmental agencies, that community entities were negligent in their management of the public health. In 1968, the Japanese government actually sorted out all of the knowledge that had been accumulated about Minamata disease up to that point, and actually gave a definitive discussion of what was happening. And their quote directly is that Minamata disease is a poisoning disease of the central nervous system caused by a methylmercury compound, which was produced as a byproduct in the process of manufacturing acetaldehyde at Chiso Company Limited in Minamata City and Showa Senko Company Limited, located upstream of Agano River. And so this is an official government declaration of primary cause of this particular disease. Okay? Once we have that identified, essentially the gavel is down. There's a decision in terms of management. There's a decision in terms of liabilities and compensation. We see that in our own environmental law as well. In terms of the geographical distribution of Minamata disease, this is an exploded map. Here you see the island country of Japan. Down here at the southern tip, we've got Minamata, and you can kind of see Minamata Bay here, this being the primary focus, the hatched area being where the inhabitants, where the case location was actually large. Up island, the Agano River, we see another one because we had a manufacturing plant up that river. We've seen the deposition of toxicants and sediments in several other case studies. In terms of exposure, what we find is that some of these inhabitants in Minamata ate 300 to 1500 grams per day of fish, with an average mercury concentration of about 3 to 4 parts per million. And these individuals suffered poisoning, okay, again being a major part of their diet. In terms of the distribution of certified patients, and we'll discuss what a certified patient is, because when you think about some of the neurotoxicological manifestations of mercury toxicity, some of these can be regarded as being having a good crossover with the manifestations of many other different types of disease. And the other thing is also what I call kind of a group effect. If I'm not feeling particularly well and I was in a community associated with exposure, perhaps I'm going to be very, very concerned that in fact not only was I exposed, but that I'm having some of the symptoms of the disease. Distribution of patients, the larger circles, as is typical for these kind of maps, here over 1,000 in Minamata Harbor. This is the disposition of the communities and the numbers of people here on the Agano River. And you can kind of see the river here downstream from the plant. And finally at the coast in terms of exposure and the certified patients for Minamata disease. One of the things in terms of vectors of exposure, we have to look at the pathways. Where was this, the primary pathways of contamination coming from? And as we said, it's fish and shellfish. If we look at Minamata Bay, what we can see is in the history here, and this is in the primary years, it starts out at 1961 over here and farms out here till about 1997. In this case, here in 1965 in Agano River Basin out to 1977. What you see here, and this is 0 to 4 parts per million wet weight total mercury. Here is 0 to 6 part per million. What you can see is that the concentrations of total mercury as analyzed in fish were significantly high, but then between 1960 and approximately 1970, in both cases, the fish total mercury concentration dropped dramatically. And so some of the management, the risk management actions that the local communities, the governmental agencies, regulatory agencies, public health officials were doing to manage this were actually challenging the contamination of fish. Primarily, these included turning off the source, the dumping, and also actually starting to dredge the bay and getting rid of the sediments associated with contamination. the cessation of the process using mercury, industrial effluent control, environmental restoration, including removal of contaminated sediments, and as well restrictions of the intake of fish and other seafood are all part of the control methodologies put into place once they really knew and understood what was going on. They actually, even earlier, before they actually determined that it was mercury and specifically methylmercury, they did identify it with the waste stream coming out of these plants because they saw these types of plants in both locations. And so turning off the discharge was the biggest primary vector of change. It took it out of the water column, the primary source out of the water column, although there was still a tremendous amount still in the sediment. In terms of the manifestation of disease, I've got a couple slides here talking about the clinical features. And again, this methylmercury is a neurotoxin. So we'll see things like sensory disorder, the distal portion of the four extremities. So your hands and your feet, we start seeing some problems, whether it be numbness, whether it be movement problems, cerebral ataxia, inability to walk, bilateral concentric constriction of the visual field, a little bit of tunnel vision development, central disorder of ocular movement, your eyes just don't move, they're a little bit jagged, hearing impairments, just disequilibrium, inability to keep your balance. There was a whole syndrome called infant Minamata disease. We'll talk about that, but it consists of both fetal disease from exposure in utero and exposure from postnatal feeding, whether it be breast food or fish in early childhood. Intellectual disorders, various degrees of neurological disorders subsequent to the ataxia, signs and symptoms of acquired Minamata disease also were found, but not necessarily with the sensory disturbances. And so there was a great array of potential clinical signs and symptoms, and we'll talk about how the disease investigators, the clinicians associated with managing public health in the area actually developed a symptomology table, so signs and symptoms of Minamata disease to classify patients. The musculature contracture in the fingers associated, and this is a photo of an individual is demonstrating that in their hand. This was observed on typical Minamata disease patients. The neuropathology, I'm not going to go through this, I list this for completeness of chronic occurrence, but what we find actually is quite interesting in the development of the disease. It's identified by very strong pronounced changes in the white matter of the brains. What happens is that sometimes it doesn't start for years after the first or primary exposure, but as many as 4 to 6 years later and 10 years later, there's significant degeneration of neurons. In this particular micro slide here at 150 magnification, you can't really see much here, but in terms of the interpretation, this particular person had about a 50% degeneration in the number of neurons in this particular part of the brain. And so there is a dramatic disintegration of neurological tissue. It is localized, it is widespread, and it is highly damaging. This has a lot to do with the fact that methylmercury can cross the lipid barrier, the blood-brain barrier, if you will. One of the follow-ups in terms of Minamata disease was something referred to as congenital Minamata disease, and this is having to do with monitoring pregnant women who were exposed in the primary times of exposure to contaminated fish, but had mild or no symptoms. But for about 22 cases, they documented something called congenital Minamata disease, where they gave birth to babies with significant developmental disabilities, including cerebral palsy, mental retardation, and seizures. And so intergenerational effects were observed. What is interest here in terms of what we learn from these clinical histories is this gives us an insight into the dose response of organomercurials, of methylmercury, in terms of neurotoxic effects in utero. It doesn't give us specific dose response analysis, but it does give us an idea of what the clinical manifestations of methylmercury are in infants and children. Diagnosis of individuals that were suffering from various signs and symptoms of Minamata disease was difficult because of the diverse range of symptoms and the fact that many of these symptoms can actually be classified with other neurological problems, various types. So in terms of typical patients that were manifesting a lot of the major symptoms, it was a lot easier, but it was far more difficult to actually find out who had this disease from exposure and who was suffering from other sorts of diseases as well. And one of the ways they did that was to develop some criteria for postnatal Minamata disease. And what I've done here in this table is put down the classification of symptoms. And this is just a letter classification, A's and B's, C's and D's, that allow the clinicians to classify patients and in terms of their workup, whether it be treatments or therapies associated with it, but mostly for diagnosis. What sorts of signs and symptoms, sensory system disorders, ataxia, disequilibrium, constriction of the visual field, CNS disorders associated with the ocular system, generalized CNS disorders or other symptoms, and then allowing this tabular sort of assessment for classification of patients, but also allowing to rule out differential diagnoses like polyneuritis, cerebrovascular disturbance, cervical spondylosis, or some sort of psychogenic disorder, that there's just something wrong with the brain development of this individual. I'm not going to go through this entire table, but I'm going to have you look at the pattern and perhaps even self-read down here. But this is a list of about 23 signs and symptoms of Minamata disease. And this is the bins down here, 1 to 23. And this is the percent, 0 to 100%. What I can tell you is that these here are generally sort of the CNS signs, the for instance, loss of visual field, slight ataxia. But the large scale ones here, these are the very debilitating physical signs and symptoms, the crippling part of the disease. And you can notice that this group right here was relatively low, 10-20% of the total patients that were presenting had this very, very large scale disability, as opposed to some of these disabilities, these neurocognitive disabilities associated with the first part of this. And so there was a wide range of individuals. Obviously, these individuals may have several of these clinical signs and symptoms associated with this disease. As it turns out, there is no specific treatment therapy for this disease. And so, other than removing source control, there wasn't a lot that the doctors could do, especially when it was a chronic manifestation. It was something that happened a little bit historically, and years went by. There are some therapies. We've talked in the course here about chelation therapy, how an antidote, so to speak, is something that competes for the metal ion, something that binds it. And so thiol groups are very popular. British anti-Lewisite is popular. EDTA, with its metal binding capabilities, is popular as a competition. Penicillamine is a metal binding drug as well. And so chelation therapy, using some of these drugs, was one of the things given to some of the patients. Function training therapy, physical therapy, in terms of trying to retrain parts of the neurological system to accommodate movement and motion, was a part of the treatment. As it turns out, when we do use chelation therapy, we put it in a Ringer solution, which is a saline solution with sugar in it. It's an IV drip infusion, and it's typically done in a more acute treatment. As it turns out, the ARAC manifestation of methylmercury poisoning, use that same sort of chelation therapy to try and treat patients. There have been follow-up analyses of ARAC as well in terms of looking at the manifestation of methylmercury and the study of the clinical disease progression. And as it turns out, the examination of congenital Minamata-type disease from ARAC actually had no findings. There was no manifestation of congenital birth defects in the population, but it was a far less controlled environment, if one can look at these public health disasters as being controlled at all. This is a graphic actually from the Japanese Ministry of the Environment, and this just so that you can kind of see that there was great concern. This is a tremendous social injustice for the people here. There was some accusations of either corporate influence or government neglect in managing the public health. And so not only the corporations tried to do the good thing in terms of establishing compensation funds, but also the government establishing funds and opportunities for lifetime health care and compensation for the patients and for the heirs of the patients. But in terms of presentation with the disease, there was a medical evaluation and a classification and essentially a certification of whether or not, a medical certification, you were a Minamata disease patient, and then classified of whether or not certain levels of compensation, including lifetime medical health care, was appropriate. I've talked about the control of the contamination. It was assumed that there was about 70 to 150 tons of mercury discharged into Minamata by the Chiso Corporation. And so they actually dredged the entire Minamata Bay. It's pretty significant. What you can see here is the land application of the dredged materials to get it out of the food chain. This actual piece of area is actually being turned into a park but taking out of the food chain in terms of potentially exposing individuals. The dredging activity was actually extremely widespread. This is a graphic of Minamata Bay, and the blue area here was the sampled area of the highest concentration of mercury in the sediments. And so during the 20-some-odd years of dredging activity, there was actually fish fences, including an acoustic fence here, that were put up in the bay to keep fish out so that they would not leave the area. There were fish traps within the area. There was obviously a lot of monitoring and management of this fishery that, you know, it was not a very good idea to do any sort of fishing for human consumption in this area. But the sediments, as they were dredged out, were land applied, and this is that area I just showed you on the other map. And a fairly large amount of area, about 2 million square meters of treated area, and about 1,500,000 cubic meters of sludge that were land applied. In terms of what we have learned, or at least what the Japanese have learned, and we share in their new knowledge on mercury. For the first time, we were allowed to kind of look at this disease manifestation, unfortunately, in a human population. We came up with some indices about the threshold values for onset of mercury toxicosis in the human body in terms of concentrations in blood, concentrations in hair, and what the body burdens are associated with in terms of mercury toxicosis. These allow us, once we know what the effect levels are, right, in dose response risk assessment, we can back that up and start developing environmental management criteria. Things like effluent standards for water pollution control in Japan. We now have total mercury at 5 parts per billion, but alkyl mercury compounds must not be detected at all in any sort of effluent discharge, the limited detection, 500 parts per trillion. It is interesting, because of the tremendous loss of life, the tremendous human impact of Minamata disease. The city has tried to learn, Japan has tried to learn from this incident. In 1996, on the 40th anniversary of Minamata, the city put up a memorial. The city on its own website actually gives three reasons as a prayer and requiem site for those who were sacrificed to this particular disease. Interesting enough, in the memorial itself, which is a water fountain, there's a box at the top that contains inscribed all the names of the patients of Minamata disease. There's a pledge locally and within Japan as well that to never allow the repetition of such disasters. There is great personal and societal angst associated with letting this happen. And there has been great sharing. I think Japan has been a leader in studying and disseminating information about mercury in the environment. In terms of what we have learned from Minamata, some of the take-home lessons, people have done analyses, many of them retrospective analyses. This is a graph from Kitamura, 1971. This is based on some of the clinical case studies associated with Minamata disease. This is the days of consumption. This is the level of consumption of, in terms of milligrams of dose methylmercury. And you can see at low doses, we have a no effect level here, line here. We have a toxic dose and we have a lethal dose. We looked at the dynamics, developed a model in terms of what doses are acceptable. We are all going to be eating fish. What is an acceptable dose for things like no effect levels, for subtoxic and toxic, and finally lethal levels? And so again, what we have tried to do is look at the available information, because we do this in toxicology when we have clinical disease, and try to learn from it, and learn that, and also put it to play in risk management scenarios. One of the risk management scenarios that we have is the development of probable, provisional, tolerable weekly intakes. The Joint Food and Agriculture Organization, World Health Organization Expert Committee on Food Additives, they recommended any use of mercury compounds that increases the level of mercury in food should be strongly discouraged. It is an unacceptable outcome. It recommended a provisional, tolerable weekly intake of 0.3 milligrams total mercury per person, of which no more than 0.2 milligrams should be present as methyl mercury. And this is for a 50 kilogram person. The Ministry of Health and Welfare in Japan set the tolerable intake, a conservative one even from the WHO guideline, as total mercury 0.25 milligrams and methyl mercury as 0.17 milligrams. Well, since that time, there have been additional studies examining mercury toxicity, and specifically methylmercury and its risk. I'm going to finish out today by talking about some of these studies and then how those studies and how the accumulated information has been put to play in the public policy arena. In 1998, there were a couple of studies done about that time, child development studies, one in the Seychelles Islands and one in the Faroe Islands. And the interesting situation here was these two geographies, the local populations, were highly dependent on seafood. And so as a primary vector of exposure, seafood is a great one. So there is a population for a well-designed, well-executed cohort study of individuals consuming large quantities of seafood. The idea, the thesis of the analysis, the retrospective analysis and the prospective analysis was, let's take a look at any sort of neurotoxicity effects in children associated with this consumption pattern. They determined prenatal methylmercury exposure, ascertained neurodevelopment outcomes following development, following delivery. The exposure levels, as it turns out, in the Faroes was about 4 part per million in terms of dietary exposure, and a little bit higher in the Seychelles at about 6 part per million. Their main cohort in the Seychelles, about 779 individuals, were followed 5 times at 6, 19, 29, 66, and 107 months after birth, with the other cohort was examined at 7 years and again at 14 years. Again, assessment for these neurodevelopment outcomes. As it turns out, there were divergent findings in these two relatively modern studies. The Seychelles, of 46 primary endpoints analyzed across 5 ages, only one of the endpoints showed a possible difference, possible adverse association with prenatal methylmercury. Okay, which begs the question, what's the problem? Because here's a community, again, consuming as a part of their diet a fair amount of methylmercury. The Faroe Islands project reported adverse associations between prenatal methylmercury exposure and tests of memory, attention, language, visual spatial perception measured at 7 years. So there was this endpoint that was observed in this one study. So we do have divergent. Unfortunately, it would have been nicer, perhaps, in terms of coming to a conclusion, if these studies produced similar results, but in fact, they produced quite different results. And as it turns out, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry here in the U.S., the National Research Council, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, actually reviewed all of these studies after 1998, 99, 2000, to kind of come up with what is the risk and what should be the advisory levels associated with methylmercury. As it turns out, US EPA did this as well and recommended a reference dose, which we learned about in terms of pesticides in the human food chain. In terms of lifetime exposures, should be lowered from 0.5 micrograms per kilogram body weight per day down fivefold to 0.1 micrograms per kilogram body weight per day. There was some concern that EPA was jumping to conclusions, especially when you look at the diversity of the two child development studies we just talked about. The National Research Council actually went in with some of the nation's best experts and examined available data. They did discount the Seychelles data because there was no significant adverse effects reported, and gave more weight to the Faroes Islands group. Actually, EPA also in 2001 then developed a fish tissue residue criterion because fish that exist in public waters are available for consumption, and that fish tissue residue criterion was developed in or released in 2001 as 0.3 milligrams of methylmercury per kilogram of fish body weight. Okay, so this is analyzing the fish. And that residue criterion is based on the reference dose. You calculate how much potential exposure, especially as we've talked about for subgroups, subgroups like subsistence livers, people that live quite a bit on fish diets as a majority of their consumption. However, it was later kind of revealed that the Faroes group had some large-scale PCB exposure because of the whale meat and the high trophic level and the blubber of whale, and that they decided may confound the mercury exposure. In other words, it wasn't just mercury. If you look at some of the bioaccumulative lipid-soluble chemicals in blubber, this may have been a part of the problem as well. In terms of some of the endpoints identified in that study. This does raise some questions about the National Research Council's conclusions associated with their analysis of the risk associated with methylmercury and the subsequent reduction by EPA from 0.5 down to 0.1. So where does that leave us in terms of the public policy and how we manage risk in the public health arena? Well, what do we know? Well, we know methylmercury is a potent neurotoxin. We know that it has increased bioavailability because we're pretty high up on the food chain. But we also need to know that governments have a requirement to minimize exposure with public health policies. So what does that leave us in terms of how do we manage when we really have a little bit of, discussion about or uncertainty regarding low-level effects? One of the focuses in terms of managing environmental exposure is to limit mercury in vaccines, and there is a great quantity of activity in the United States right now looking into thiomersal, which is the mercury compound in vaccine coming up with for stabilizing it from microbial degradation. As it turns out, even with millions and millions of dollars of investment by researchers and pharmaceutical companies, they have not come up with an acceptable alternative. Thimerosal is about 46% mercury by weight. It's a small amount of mercury, but it is something that is directly injected, typically in childhood immunizations. And so there's direct dosing associated at the stage of development that is of greatest concern in terms of neurotoxicological development. We also have some issues associated with dental amalgams and release of mercury and some concern there. It's mixed in terms of the risk assessment that you see, although the dental industry is moving away from amalgams to some more modern bonding, ceramic bonding techniques. And there is a focus on limiting fish consumption in general during pregnancy because of the risk of in utero exposure. But there are some differences in U.S. agencies, FDA, EPA, ATSDR, about the data quality associated with low-dose methylmercury. There is a problem associated with fish consumption advisories in non-polluted environments. Obviously, if we have a highly polluted environment, that's a management tool. But in terms of advisories for people who eat a lot of fish, and we have a lot of data, cardiovascular data, about the health benefits of things like omega-3 fatty acids associated with fish consumption. And so taking a major food source out of the human diet has its problems, as well as exposing people to some of the concerns about vaccine safety, but even more so the public health concerns of people not getting vaccinated. What we find then is that we have a real need for low-dose research. What we don't have right now is enough information. I think governments have acted responsibly in all cases in terms of the existing information. There is some concern of whether or not that is adequately protective or overly protective. What we find, though, in terms of the environmental history of mercury, is that it is truly a mysterious element that has been with us for all time and will continue to be not only a useful metal, but something that will be a part of our life in terms of the human experience, and is something that we need to give great attention to in terms of managing in the environment. With that, I thank you very much, and we'll see you next time when we'll talk about the future of environmental toxicology. Thanks.